Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, David Herrera, attorney registration number 12818. May it please the court, counsel. Jerry Willis presented his case to a jury now many years ago, and the jury found in his favor on all counts, on all points. This case involved a contract to provide his expertise in development and getting entitlements and in getting funding from governmental sources for a mixed-use development in downtown Fort Collins, Colorado. The contract that was entered into provided for a partnership arrangement where there was to be a split between the two parties, Mr. Willis and Mr. Glebe, as to a partnership share. There was also an agreement that Mr. Glebe was to get a development fee and Mr. Willis was to get a commission on the real estate portion of the project. Mr. Glebe wrote at the outset and throughout the relationship that we agree that you will get 6% commission on all sales regardless of where they originate. That statement is made repeatedly, but most notably in the record on exhibits 14, I think, and 41 in particular, to a third party, reaffirming the agreement. There was a split in the share as partners, based upon the development partner getting 12.5%, the land partner getting 13.6%, 25% for the development partner, of which the jury found Mr. Willis was half, so we got 12.5% by the verdict. Land partner was to Mr. Willis was found to be entitled to 13.6% of the project, and equity partner 8.3% of the project. Now, the following the trial, there was a motion and a finding by the court that on a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, the JNOV. The court said that the jury's award of $199,567 for the 6% commission could not be awarded because Mr. Willis was not the procuring cause under the statute. We believe, and I think that the law supports this, that this was an exclusive listing agreement. It was an agreement for which there was consideration given by Mr. Willis at the beginning of this relationship, before the project was developed and ready to be sold, but that was part of his contract. That was part of his agreement. He expended time and money, he performed services under that agreement. The record is replete with the things that he did and the praise that he got from Mr. Glebe for the work that he did. Under the case law, we believe this became an irrevocable agreement. Mr. Willis, as an exclusive listing contract, did not have to be the procuring cause of the ultimate buyers. But in fact, he was precluded from being able to perform his portion of the contract reasonably within the time that the project could be sold.
Our court also said that he wasn't entitled to the commission because the agreement, to the extent there was an agreement, was rescinded.
Because it was rescinded?
Well, it was terminated. Perhaps not rescinded, but I think the trial court's words were terminated.
I understand. And in fact, we say that when consideration was given, it could not be revoked. It could not be terminated. It was irrevocable by the case law that deals with this subject, Garrett versus Richardson. Here he provided labor, money, skill, expertise. That was his contract. By saying, we're not going to honor this contract anymore, you don't get that any longer, that's the breach of contract that the jury found. The jury found that there was a contract, that there was offer, acceptance, consideration, and that Mr. Willis performed his part under that. Nevertheless, the court said, well, it's revoked. Well, it could not be revoked by operation of law, Garrett versus Richardson.
Mr. Herrera, pardon me for interrupting. This case would be a lot simpler if there had been a contract between your client and Mr. Glebe that said, okay, here's what the various responsibilities are. What we're doing what your argument is, I believe, and please tell me if I'm wrong, is you're piecing together from a series of emails the fact that there was an agreement, right? We don't have that sort of definitive written document that we can sit down and say, okay, we understand rights and responsibilities. They apparently had some sort of handshake thing that got commemorated through emails, right? Am I right about that?
That's true. There were a series of emails, most of which generated by Mr. Glee, when he admitted the essential terms of the agreement throughout the relationship, all the way through Exhibit 41, where he reaffirmed it in January the following year. All the essential terms of this agreement, those aren't really in dispute. He admitted all of those essential terms, that there was agreement for splitting of the profit. There was, he was a partner. They represented that throughout to everyone, to each other, to third parties, to the government, to funding agencies, to lenders, to everyone. They represented those relationships existed. The listing agreement was oral. All of this was oral, but in fact, there were email back and forth between these parties confirming this relationship. And the fact that it was an oral agreement does not mean it's not still an enforceable agreement. And we would say that Hayes versus North Table Mountain is the case that speaks to that subject. That was an oral agreement as well and fully enforceable. There are so many issues in this case. One of them is that I want to move to is the punitive damage award, a difficult problem. And for the court, I would say that probably the best case in this, which I regret I didn't really emphasize enough in the brief, is the McRae versus Dwyer case, which is pretty close on the facts to this particular case.
So, Herrera, yes. With respect to the punitive damages claim, punitive damages were awarded in connection with the fraud claim, as I understand it.
Yes, in the verdict form, that's correct.
Could you bring a fraud under Town of Alma and the economic loss rule that's been the law in the state of Colorado now for several years, when your fraud claim arose out of the same facts and circumstances as the breach of contract?
Independent duty, Your Honor. I believe that there was an independent duty, breach of fiduciary duty, as between partners, that is recognized as the exception to the economic loss rule. In this particular case, interesting on the McRae versus Dwyer case, at the end of that case, and I asked the court to take a look at this, at the very end of that case, the court reduced the damages award because the plaintiff did not segregate between the tort claim and the contract claim in the definition of damages. So the court on its own reduced the tort claim damages because the court considered those to be a duplication. This is an integrated set of facts in this case where they arose from the same set of facts. They continued throughout. It was pled in the pleadings in this particular case. And in fact, we believe, although inartful pleading, or perhaps on my part in drafting the verdict form that I didn't do, it was in the Harris group case to link up the various claims. But we believe quite clearly that this case was attended by fraud. The jury found that fraud was willful and wanton by clear and convincing evidence.
And this really what my first question was related to is this wasn't a breach of fiduciary duty claim, as I understand it. It was a fraud claim. The allegation was there were facts that were misstated or facts that were omitted, and as a result of that, your client suffered damages, all of which arose out of the same facts and circumstances that underlay the breach of contract claim. Under those circumstances, there is no independent duty because it's collapsed into the breach of contract claim under the economic loss rule.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that we did plead breach of fiduciary duty. The jury did find that. The jury found that breach was the fraud. we believe. That's what was argued. That was what was presented to the jury. We believe that there is an independent duty by a partner that is different from the contract duty that existed in this particular case, and we believe that's the exception that is applicable. By the way, that was not argued at any time. It wasn't preserved on appeal, but I understand the court's question on that. The next issue...
We can affirm the trial court on any basis.
Understood. Understood, Your Honor. The next issue that I wanted to go to, Your Honor, and this is the more or less the... If the court finds that there's a partnership, and we believe there's ample evidence on the record to support the jury's finding that there was a partnership, that these are issues that fact that were in dispute, that properly given to the jury to decide. That was the first verdict that the jury found. Association of Two or More Persons Carrying as Co-Owners a Business for Profit by act, by contract or by conduct. The jury found that expressly. We believe there's no question under the facts, by the admissions that were given here, by the sharing of ownership and by the conduct that they gave, the representations of third parties, that this was a partnership, speaking to the cross appeal. Now, as to that, if the court does find that there's a partnership, then we get to this other issue of damages and the allocation of damages and going to the special master. We believe that there are some fundamental errors here with regard to the transcript that involved the special master. It is the special master's duty. It was not taken out by the order of referral, that the no transcript was necessary.
Mr. Herrera, I have a related question to the issue of the special master, although not specifically about the transcripts. You're claiming now that it was error for the trial court not to hold a hearing on the special master's findings, but why should we find that you preserved that error when it wasn't your client who requested a hearing?
Well, it, because it had been requested and ordered, he was still within his time and right to request it, and the court ordered the hearing.
And how can your client complain about the lack of a hearing when your client never asked for it in the first place?
Your Honor, I believe that, one, it's part of the rule that there shall be a hearing before the court rules on the special master's findings. It's not discretionary. It was requested by one of the other parties. That was not waived, and it was ordered by the court. So we believe that there's no error for Mr. Willis to also not request the hearing when it was required as part of the rule, and it was requested and ordered by the defendant in the case. We think that's a pretty straightforward error for the court not to grant not to hold the hearing that is required by Rule 53. Now, as to the transcript, there are some, and another reason that there should have been a hearing on this is because of not only the being able to put on evidence with regard to the record that the special master had, but as well because of some extrajudicial communications that had occurred between the special master and the court, because of the issues with whether or not the entire transcript had been submitted and filed. The court well knows that there was an issue in this case. Where was the transcript, not only the transcript, but the evidence from the special master hearing? When I asked for it as part of the record on appeal, it wasn't there. Then a supplemental request came in and it was there. And that's how it came forward to the court. There's a question is what made up that record that the court saw and reviewed in making its findings on the special master's recommendations. As well on the issue of did Mr. Willis mislead the court? There was never any opportunity for Mr. Willis under oath to give his testimony or to cross-examine anyone with regard to that particular issue. I would say that the record on that is somewhat misstated. The court said that plaintiff represented that he paid for the transcript. Mr. Willis at page 1733 of the record ordered the entire transcript. That's what he represented to the court. That's true. At 1738 of the record, Mr. Willis told the court after April 17th that he paid a $3,000 deposit. He never represented to the court that he paid for the entire transcript. He would not have represented that because he couldn't have paid for the entire transcript. But the court held against him on this particular issue, saying that he had misled the court. he didn't have the opportunity to dispute any of that, Your Honor. We'd ask the court to reverse on all points and to remand to the court with instructions, and in particular with regard to the special master proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herrera.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Goddard, attorney registration number 17645, and I represent the appellees. Although, as Mr. Herrera said, there are many issues in this case, I want to focus my time on two issues, but I'll answer questions on any issues you have. The issues I want to address is that Mr. Willis did not earn any commissions as a matter of law because he was not the procuring cause. The second issue is on the punitive damage claim and the fact that he cannot get punitive damages because he did not prevail on any tort claim. First thing I think you have to address, and that's what the trial court addressed, is that this case was tried, in fact, as a brokerage commission case. It was, all you have to do is look at verdict form number 24, which is the breach of the, with regard to commissions, look at jury instruction number 23, which is the classic instruction on procuring cause, and specifically says, you must find Mr. Willis as a broker, you must find Mr. Willis as a procuring cause, you must find everything down the line for finding on favor of a broker on a commissions claim. It wasn't tried as part of a partnership compensation claim. That was something created after the fact. All you have to do is look at the record, just like the trial court did. Second point is, Colorado law has always followed the rule since the Moore decision, Moore v. Tall, Mapes v. City Council Walsenburg, that a broker is entitled to a commission only if the broker is the procuring cause of the sale. No exception. Look at the Cooley investment case. That's probably one of the best cases, and it's cited in our brief at page 23. And that case applied section 1261.201, which is a procuring cause statute, to an exclusive listing contract, just what is claimed here. Although that exclusive listing contract was in writing, this one is allegedly an oral. And that case, if you look at the language 780 Pacific 2D at 31, the court says that absent the production of a ready, willing, and able buyer, Section 1261.201 prohibits any award of commission, even if the seller breached the listing contract by an early termination. That's this case. Now, they said you can recover for out-of-pocket damages and other damages if you proved them, but you can't recover a commission. And that's what this case is. This case was mistried. If you wanted to argue that there was a breach because Mr. Glebe early terminated a listing agreement, different damages. They took it to the jury on the basis of the commission. They didn't even attempt to present any evidence that Mr. Willis was a procuring cause. They don't even argue to this court that there's any evidence that Mr. Willis was a procuring cause. They argue that you don't have to meet the procuring cause standard because it was an exclusive listing contract. Nowhere in any decision in Colorado are you going to find that proposition. It doesn't exist. The law is, if you want to get a commission, you must be the procuring cause. Second point, I want to quickly distinguish Garrett, because that's miscited too. I want you to look at how the court, the Supreme Court, framed the issue at 369 Pacific 2D at 568. And they said, where the owners sign an exclusive, irrevocable listing agreement for a reasonable specified time, and where the broker during the time of the listing produces a buyer who is ready, willing, and able to buy on the terms of the listing, may the owner then revoke the listing? Of course, no. He's already earned the commission. He earns the commission by being the procuring cause. The fact that the seller chooses not to accept that transaction then does not prevent the broker from being the procuring cause. That's all the case stands for. In that case, the seller entered into a written exclusive listing agreement with the broker. Broker brought a person to the seller, not on terms of the listing agreement. The seller said no, and furthermore, I'm going to terminate the agreement. Broker then got out, went back to that prospective purchaser and got them to increase their offer so that it met the listing terms, brought the offer back to the seller, and the seller said no, I terminate my agreement. Of course, you can't say you've terminated your agreement at that point. The commission's been earned. The next point I want to make is that you don't have an enforceable listing agreement in this case. You don't have a written listing agreement. And Colorado has never accepted an oral listing agreement when that broker was not the procuring cause. There's not a case that you're going to find dealing with a subagent and on an oral listing agreement. And if you're going to go that far, this is not the case to do it, because here there's no agreement on listing price, there's no agreement on the duration of the listing, and there's no agreement on whether you're going to use multi-list. And multi-list agreement on use of subagents is so important that a division of this court in Jorgensen said you can't have a listing agreement without an agreement on multi-list or use of subagents. Here, the only agreement was, as counsel said, is this vague statement that you get 6% of all sales no matter where they come from. Now, I would submit to you that if you look at the reply brief at 6, the plaintiff even admits that they really didn't have a written a listing agreement. They say plaintiff never received an exclusive listing agreement. I agree with that. They didn't receive an exclusive listing agreement. They just received this vague oral promise that you'll get 6% of the commissions of the sales. It takes a lot more for that to have an exclusive listing agreement, as the trial court found in the order granting the JNOV. And if that's right, then I am right that under Cooley, if you don't have a listing agreement, then you don't get an award of commissions. What you get are some other damages, but they were never proven in the trial court because the case was mistried.
Counsel, pardon me for interrupting, if I may, please. Is it possible that you can have an agreement to get a certain percentage of commissions that is just simply a straight contractual agreement? Assume for the purposes of argument that you and I enter into a contract, I'm going to sell some stuff. That's what I'm going to do. But you tell me, look, Bernard, I like you so much that I want to make sure that you get your money out of this. So 6% of whatever gets sold, I don't care who sells it, when it's sold, how it's sold, but you're going to get 6% of that. Assume that's clear in a written contract.
Is a contract a brokerage contract?
Well,
it's critical. It's critical because brokerage contracts are different than any other contract.
I understand, but can't you have a different kind of contract that could have that result?
Yes, you could have a different kind of contract, right, but not a brokerage contract, because brokerage contracts have certain requirements, and this contract does not, this oral agreement does not meet those requirements. Even if you wanted to go that far and allow an oral exclusive listing agreement in Colorado without an unspecified duration, contrary to any other decision, then you still have to deal with 1261-8091B, because it's undisputed that there was no performance. There was no bringing of a ready loan buyer under this by Mr. Willis. And that statute says that a listing agreement not performed or not completed for any reason terminates on the earliest of the agreed date. We don't have an agreed date because there's no specified date. Relinquishment of the parties. Well, that was February 9, 2004, when Mr. Bleep said he didn't want anything to do with Mr. Willis. And, or on 1 year after it was formed. Well, if it was formed by this handshake deal, then it terminated, had to terminate by statute in June or July 2004. As the trial court found, as of that time, there was nothing to sell. So there was no listing agreement in place at the time Mr. Willis could have even sold any units. It was terminated. Now, the final point I want to make on this quickly is that Mr. Willis himself cannot argue that he didn't accept that termination. And that's because he admitted at trial that not only did he not make any effort to find a procuring a willing buyer for to sell any, to purchase any of the units, he said that he considered Mr. Glebe, the seller, his enemy, and he would not work for the enemy. He said, you don't, the words he used was, you don't work for the enemy, let someone else do that, I have a conscience. He said that if I had a prospective buyer, I would take them to a different project, not this one. How can you possibly be an agent under an exclusive listing contract and still saying that I'm not going to do anything to find a willing buyer? I would say that's clear, unequivocal evidence of Mr. Willis's acceptance of the termination by Mr. Glebe, and therefore, because Mr. Willis was not the procuring cause of any transaction, he could not, as a matter of law, earn a commission. Some other damages, if it was tried as a promissory estoppel case, tried on some other basis, maybe, but not for commissions as a jury, and that's what the jury awarded, and that was there. I want to move quickly to the punitive damages, and I think that's pretty clear, but I do need to make one statement that I misquoted the mortgage finance decision in my brief at 18. What I said was you can't recover punitive damages unless the breach is willful and wanton. Well, that's completely wrong. But the mortgage finance holds that you cannot recover punitive damages for breach of contract even if there is a specific finding that the breach was willful, wanton, and attended by circumstances of fraud. So it's further on. Here, the jury didn't find that the breach of contract was attended by circumstances of fraud. That's just argument. You won't find it anywhere in the record. But even if that were true, mortgage finance says, no, you cannot recover punitive damages for breach of contract. The portion I was citing was where the court was discussing the Davis v. Bradley decision, where they said the Court of Appeals had previously confused compensatory damages, which you can recover mental suffering for a breach of a contract that's willful and wanton, with punitive damages for which you cannot, under any circumstances, recover punitive damages for breach of a contract. Now, you can recover punitive damages for breach of a contract if the breach is also an independent tort, such as it constitutes outrageous conduct. But here, the jury specifically found that Mr. Willis did not prevail on any tort. Now, I disagree with Mr. Herrera's statement that the jury found in favor of Mr. Willis on all claims. Well, how can you find in favor of someone on a claim when you didn't find all the elements of the claim? One of the elements of the claim of any fraud claim is damages. If you say the person suffered no damages, then they could not prevail on that claim because they didn't prove all the elements. That's what the trial court found. If you look at the order where that was entered in the case, the trial court did not enter judgment in favor of Mr. Willis on the tort claims. It entered judgment in favor of Mr. Glebe and the other appellees because the jury specifically found Mr. Willis suffered no damages on any of the tort claims. Now, with regard to Judge Graham's comments on the economic loss rule and whether these facts are the same underlying facts, that's argument of counsel. If you look at the record, I don't think you can tell what the jury was talking about when it said there was a misrepresentation or breach of fiduciary duty because they weren't asked to specify. All they did is find that there was some misrepresentation somewhere and there was some concealment somewhere and some breach of fiduciary duty somewhere. But whatever it was, Mr. Willis did not suffer any damages. That's what the jury found. Now, it could be that there's the same underlying facts. It also could be, and if you look at the closing argument, you can see it may have been this argument that what Mr. Glebe did was represented to various agencies of the public and various people that he was entering into this partnership with Mr. Willis, and then he came into the courtroom and said, I didn't enter into a partnership with Mr. Willis, and therefore the jury found that we're just wasting our time because you already said you had a partnership, you already did this, and you should stick with your word. And that would kind of explain why the jury says, well, you're entitled then to half your attorney fees. That's a strange award of punitive damages as well. But regardless of all that, the fact is that Mr. Willis did not prevail on any tort claim. Therefore, he cannot claim any punitive damages. Now, this claim that he somehow elected it was a contract procured through fraud, elected to frame the contract, that's no different than a breach of contract. If you want to argue fraud, I was fraudulently induced to enter the contract, argue fraud. You elect to affirm that contract, you are in breach of contract. You want to say it's attenuated by circumstances of fraud, you're back in the mortgage finance and says no punitive damages. They reversed the Court of Appeals on that very issue in the mortgage finance. I'm not going to get to my other issues, so I just want to say quickly that We ask the court to affirm the JNOV. We ask the court to affirm the striking of the punitive damage award. On the special master report, the court did not err in approving the special master report without reviewing the entire transcript of the proceedings when neither party provided a transcript for the court to review. We ask the court to find in the circumstance of the case that the trial court was not required to hold an evidentiary hearing when both parties submitted their arguments in writing and neither party claimed there was any additional evidence to present to the court. As Judge Fox said, if Mr. Willis wanted to argue, say, I need a hearing, he should have said something. Finally, we ask the court to find that as a matter of law, that on the facts of this case, there was no partnership. What there was were a lot of discussions. We're going to enter a partnership, but if you look at all the facts and all the emails, you can see there really was no agreement on the meeting of the minds on all essential factors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Goddard. Thank you again, Mr. Herrera. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.